Welcome to the Unscripted SEO Interview Podcast. Yes, it's 100% unscripted, 100% unrehearsed, 100% unedited, and 100% real. I'm your host, Mark A. Preston. And today, we have a special guest who's, well, personally, I've been advised that he's one of the most advanced people in local SEO. So rather
advanced,
than me,
advanced in age is one of the advantages. So I mean, been in it so long that I'm now advanced in multiple ways.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, I'm on the retirement plan. So could you just so I don't do you any injustice, could you introduce yourself and your history and your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So Mike Blumenthal, and I've been doing local SEO one form or another since I was a child. My family had a retail business, 50 employees, 5 million people that got our arses kicked, and we had to close up doors in 2001. When that happened, I created a open source content management tool and started building websites for local businesses, and realized that I needed to learn SEO because I lived in a rural area, and if these had any chance of being seen, I needed SEO. So they were local websites, so I did regular SEO for localized websites. And in 2005, when Google Maps came out, I was very intrigued by it, particularly after they merged the business listings and the map components in early 2006. So I started writing about it. I thought it was the most significant development in the internet to come along, because it allowed local businesses to be visible globally and as opposed to what historically been global businesses visible locally. So it gave local, and it kicked the yellow pages in the knees at the time, which I was very much in favor of. So I started writing about it at my blog at blumenthals.com. And I wrote about it with the intention of learning about it. I didn't really know that much, but I felt like if I could ask questions and answer those questions through my own research, I might get someplace. Through that, I met a number of really wonderful people, David Mim and Mary Bowling and Mike Ramsey. We started Local U in 2010, which was a local digital marketing training seminar that went around to mid-sized cities around the United States. Through that, I met Don Campbell in 2012, started a company called Gather Up, which was to help businesses with managing and optimizing their reputation, both around reviews and around net promoter score. And throughout all of that, I was consulting in local, doing research in local, still doing my web hosting and web design business. So in 2017, I sold my web hosting, web design business. In 2019, I sold Local U to Joy Hawkins at Sterling Sky. And so Don Campbell and my other partners sold Gather Up in 2019. And then I started a new company called Near Media, whose goal is to optimize user experience on Google and websites through consumer market research. So we actually look at how consumers behave on Google and on websites and track that, tabulate that anecdotally and structurally, and provide insights to large multi-location businesses how to best optimize their efforts to maximize their returns. I also currently write at Near Media, where we do 3 times a week newsletter and other research.
Wonderful. I'm going to say that's quite a backstory there. I'm going to say it's in the local SEO space. Have you personally, do you feel as though it's actually changed a lot during those years or not really?
The competitive landscape changed. I mean, in 2006, 2007, 2008, it wasn't clear that Google would establish the monopoly that they now have. now that Google has established that monopoly quite clearly, and the other players have largely left the field, Google hasn't changed that much. They never throw an algorithm away. They may twist the dials and change parameters, but their basic algorithm is largely the same as the elements that I discussed in 2007 and 2008. Certainly, it's more sophisticated as they are able to gather more information to bring into the algorithm, but the basic algorithm is largely the same. So the answer to your question is the industry is largely different because it has Google has essentially wiped out almost all competitors. And yet Google, to a large extent, is the same. Now, again, there's variations and there's certainly more and more information they're looking to get, and that brings new variables into the mix. But the basic underlying ranking algorithm hasn't changed. So,
right. Now, is there a different algorithm of Google for local SEO than there is for standard national phrases? Is it a totally different algorithm to use?
The local algorithm is based around three primary attributes. Prominence, which is also used in the national algorithm, relevance, which is also used, but the thing that is unique in local is proximity. The other thing that's unique in local is they aren't looking at web pages, they're looking at entities in a knowledge graph and sub-entities in the knowledge graph and sub-entities of the sub-entities in the knowledge graph. So what Google brings, so local is different in that it looks at this proximity issue. It also looks at a knowledge graph and oftentimes will evaluate things like mentions of a business and a brand, and those mentions might provide, or reviews, which are not as prevalent in the national algorithm. And those reviews and mentions of a business are then aggregated into relevance and prominence and used in ranking. So it is based on the same logic, particularly the prominence aspect, which looks at how popular is a particular web page or location, but they do it slightly differently, and then they add to it proximity.
Right. So when, say, a local SEO advisor or a business has done all the foundational work, so they've got the business profile all sorted and pretty, they, you know, got the pages right on the website and everything, I want to talk a bit more about then what, because a lot of people I speak to, they think, right, I've ticked all the boxes, so why should we work with a local SEO specialist? Because we've already ticked all the boxes. What happens after that?
Mm-hmm. So there's a number of things that happen after that. Firstly, the market in which that business exists is constantly changing. The competitors are constantly changing, constantly evolving. One of the big attributes of all of Google's algorithms are links, and links around location, whether internal or external links, are critical. And it takes a serious amount of work if you're in a competitive market in local and need to develop a good link profile. That's typically best done by a trustworthy, and I underline that word, professional. Similarly, with mentions of your business name, which are a local attribute where you are become visible in the local press or in your trade press, typically that's best done with a PR person who's also likely a professional. Very difficult to do that well if you're a single business or a single practitioner. Obviously, the world of reviews, which is critical and local, both for rank initially, but ultimately for conversions, is an ongoing process. It doesn't end after you get 5 or 10 and you achieve whatever rank benefit there is. The benefit of reviews continue to accrue in terms of increasing Google's understanding of your business. And so the need for implementing some sort of processes. Now, if you're just a single location with just a few customers, that might be easy to do off the cuff. But as soon as you get beyond that and scale or size, you really need to implement a professional system. And that might require a SaaS product or a professional to do it. Photography is another example. Photographs are playing a huge issue in Google's understanding of your business, customers' willingness to convert when they see your business. So regularly getting new photographs, professional photographs, brought in and implemented, that requires professionals. So a lot of what is now helping a listing stand out, well, gee, I could keep going here, products. You know, obviously Google and local is going very granular to down to the product level. If you do a search for cameras, you're going to see Google Surface, like say a Nikon digital camera, you're going to see Google Surface, both national and local results for that, even down to the product level. So if you've got some e-commerce capability, you may need a professional to implement a good POS or e-commerce site, and then you need a professional to help you integrate that into Google Local so that you can play in those searches. And even at the level of communication or reservations, if you, for example, Google has messaging in Google Local, it's often its own silo, and a lot of times you want one messaging system to manage all of your leads, then you're going to need to work with a company that something like Leadferno that I help, you know, that I'm a funder of and an advisor to. They help you take all of your text incoming messaging, whether it's from Facebook or Google or text, and consolidate them into a single place and respond to those leads so you can convert them, those local leads, more quickly. So in every aspect of competing in this, from rank to relevance to reputation to visual stuff to communications to product display, typically it is getting increasingly complicated and can't be done without a professional because there's so many sort of knobs to turn and buttons to push that you need a professional, often multiple professionals, to do that. Your job is safe, I guess. Your job.
Wonderful. Right. So on the business profile side, how important are things like Q&As and Google posts?
Well, I view those things as sort of table stakes. When a customer starts looking in a category for a business, having more information there rather than less helps you find the right customers and get rid of the wrong customers, helps you qualify them keep you in the running for consideration. So Q&A and Google posts are a way to communicate some of the more common things that your business does so that you can stay in the running, so that you can hopefully win this customer at the end. So for example, I just did a bunch of research in the United States in healthcare. Every customer wanted to know if they were still taking new patients, which insurances they carried. Those are questions that could easily be answered in Google Post or Google Q&A. If you upvote the Q&A, they then show on your knowledge graph, and they can then be seen by searchers right then and there so that they can feel comfortable continuing to develop a relationship and decide that you're the right place to come to. So you take those things but they're table stakes. They're not something that's going to help you rank higher but they will help you not to lose potential consideration.
Oh, so not necessarily a ranking factor, but more of a conversion factor. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, more of a conversion factor. Right. And to keep people moving along the direction of getting to the point where they're going to hit the contact you, the message you, or the call you button, right, which is the goal.
Yeah. So, right. The way I see, obviously, locality, it's one big picture, but you have your website and you have your business profile. Is how much of an impact does each have? Are you seeing that the business profiles are generating a lot more exposure than, say, top-ranking websites for local phrases?
It's very category-dependent. So if it's very category and need dependent. There are what I call high consideration queries. We did some research with an employment lawyer. This is where we posited to people that they were having difficulty on the job and they might need to hire a solicitor, a lawyer. And for people like that, the website is incredibly important because they need to, their life is in the balance. So they're going to do more research. They're not going to just stop at a picture on Google and make a decision. On the other hand, if it's somebody who's looking for a new general practitioner or a new OBGYN, they might go in there, they might look in Google Local, see how close the business is, make sure it's adequate that way, make sure it deals with the questions they have about insurance and new patients, see how many reviews they have, get rid of anybody that doesn't have at least, you know, 10 reviews and a 4.7 or 4.8 average, and they're going to pick from that short list. Now, interestingly, in that category, what we saw was people going very deep into the local finder. People didn't just pick from the top three. Once they were in the local finder for something like a new primary care physician or a new OBGYN, they would go very, very deep looking for businesses that met their criteria. So in that case, again, reviews or lack of information could lead to somebody rejecting you as an option, but they could also contribute to them picking you, but they didn't stop at the top three. The long tail was very deep and very wide. They went down 6, 7, 8, 9, 12, 15 places to find people that met their criteria, and then they would make a decision from the 4 or 5 there. So it depends. So from a user conversion point of view, it depends on category. From a ranking point of view, Google can't rank your local listing, your profile, without having a sources to do that. Now, with a knowledge graph, what they're actually ranking is an entity in a database. In other words, and your website contributes to it, but so do articles in newspapers contribute to it. So do reviews on websites contribute to it. So it isn't just, in terms of ranking, just Google listing and website. It's Google listing and website and all of the other stuff from around the internet that contributes to Google's understanding of your entity, both in terms of relevance and prominence.
Right. On the website side, I've seen a lot of websites that's gone on the local website, bricks and mortar, and the idea is they want to get physically through the front door. So them sort of businesses. And they've set a blog up and they've started writing about their industry. Now, when I've looked at the stats around that, I'd say only 2% are their target audience, as in geographical. So if a local business wants to move forward and build the brand up through the blog, what does every article have to have a local entity in order to make sure it's matched to their geographical location?
Well, obviously every business has to define their reality for themselves. As a general purpose, blogging in local is not, it, again, depends on the business. Give me some examples. Are we talking about a single location business? Are we talking about a multi
location business? Well, the one that I've got in mind is one brand. They've got 4 locations within a 50-mile radius.
Right. As you pointed out, very little. If they're looking to build a national brand for some reason, then blogging makes sense. Like if they want to build, you know, because they have partially local and partially online. Like me, for example, I speak nationally. I get customers locally and nationally and internationally. So for me, blogging made a lot of sense because it allowed me to expose myself to a very broad audience. But from a pure local point of view, if you do not have a goal beyond your market, then I'm not sure any blogging is worth it. I think you're better off writing long tail content in the silos of your business where that content is relevant. So you have a product A, you want to write more about that product A, put it in product A's content silo, linking back and forth to the main page, adding nuance and detail to that, rather than isolating it out on a blog that isn't going to get read or is going to be seen by Google as not permanent information. You know, so it depends. But if you're strictly going after a local audience and you really know your product well and you want to make that understood, then I would, rather than blogging, I would bring those extended articles into your main website as subpages in the silos in which that content is relevant.
Wonderful. Right. Now, again, with the local entity, on the business profiles, the fact that anybody can basically update your profile and add images and everything, whether it's relevant or not relevant, I find that, well, I spend a lot of time filtering out what I call unrelated rubbish. You know, they're not genuine customers, they're not, you know, even photos of the business or anything. It's just, but I just find it frustrating that people that have nothing to do with your business can impact what's happening and showing. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so Google, first let's step back and help people understand why Google allows that to happen. They have a lot of faith in their ability, faith beyond their actual capability, to parse what's meaningful information and what isn't. They want multiple sources of information, and then they throw it all together with their magical AI and decide what's real and then present that. And they do that in an effort to keep the listings current so users can contribute reviews, photos, information, hours, whether you're open or closed to a listing. And Google does all of that with the goal of making sure that their business listings are more current than anybody else's in the market. And to some extent, they have succeeded at that, but it creates headaches for people. I typically recommend tools to do that because it's hard to remember to go out and check your business dashboard every day, your listing every day. So there are two tools that I like that do this. One is WhiteSpark and the other is Plepper. Both of these tools actually look at the changes that are happening on your listing and send you alerts. And then you go in and see whether you need to deal with it. And this, the more locations you have, the more critical a tool becomes, because otherwise you're wasting a lot of time. And then, depending on what it is that was posted, you need to make sort of business class decisions about whether or not to dispute that information. At Near Media, I've written a number of posts about how to, you know, get rid of fake reviews, for example, or how to recover missing reviews. But to some extent, those are cost. You have to make a cost-benefit analysis. If you have 50 reviews, and somebody leaves a fake rating, which that's negative, nobody's ever going to see, and actually takes you from a 5.0 to a 4.9 rating because of that fake rating, should you spend time to fight it? My answer is no, it actually helps you. And you shouldn't spend any effort trying to get rid of it. Now, if somebody writes a long form review that is full of untruths and other issues, then you probably should, because that might be highlighted. But a rating is going to get buried by Google, never seen by anybody. A 4.9 rating is going to be more believable than a 5.0. And you actually should be thanking that person that gave you the fake one-star rating, not worrying about whether to get rid of it, as opposed to the very detailed but inaccurate or maligning review that might violate terms of service. That review, you might want to spend time dealing with. I've again written, you know, articles how to get rid of these reviews. And if it's a review attack where a competitor is going after your business repeatedly, that for sure you want to deal with. So yeah, it depends a little bit on what the content is, back to the original question, and how much impact it has on you. Sometimes the impact is emotional, not real, like in the case of a negative rating. But I generally like to use tools to keep me apprised of these changes.
Right. And would you say it's relatively easy to get rid of them if it's going to cause harm to your business and it's not genuine?
Relatively easy is a relative term.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yes. Google has, particularly since the advent of more regulation in Europe, the SA and other regulations in Europe, has made forms available to deal with these inaccuracies. If the form fails because you're dealing with some person in India that doesn't know what they're doing, or somebody someplace doesn't know what they're doing, you can then escalate them to the form. But you need to know to go to the Google contact form. You need to know which phrases to use to get the right form. You need to get the right form. You need to submit the right form. You need to follow up, perhaps even do an appeal in the case of review. And then if all of that failed, then you need to go to the forum and ask for additional help. So is it easy? No. Is it possible? Yes.
Right. Now, personally, I deal with a lot of businesses that merge together. So they're in the same town and they provide the same services, but the two different names, and they're merging into a new name. And I found recently that the merger process within the business profiles has become a lot more frustrating. You know, right. like Google will say, well, you need to rename that one to match that one, and you do that, then they penalize them, they suspend them both because of duplication. So it's like the whole merger process just seems to be a bit crazy because we're trying to follow things, and it's just, well, we followed them, but then you pull both of them.
So over the past 2 years, Google has implemented much more rigorous tracking to try to guarantee both verification and more rigorous suspensions to try to clean up the index. The index has over the last 15, 18 years been abused by people thinking they should be able to use Google Maps as a marketing tool, whether legitimately or not. And as a result of that, and as a result, like I said, of additional European sort of oversight, Google, around 2.5 years ago, first started cleaning up service area businesses. Any change you made would lead to a suspension, and then you'd have to get re-included and prove your bona fides by providing, you know, proof of existence and where you did business, your business documents, et cetera. Subsequent to that, or maybe simultaneously with that, they also upped the verification procedures. So, for example, now, unless you're a long-standing business with a lot of exterior signals and Google Search Console implemented with the same email as your Google My Business, and, you know, you're not going to get a postcard anymore. You're going to be forced into some form of video verification. And even things like, again, to prevent fraud, name changes and moves have been made more difficult, often requiring re-verification, again, to limit fraud, because they have confidence in the old business. They don't have confidence in the new one. So, yes, it has gotten more difficult. More rigorous combined with an obtuse system makes it really hard to know which path you should follow. And it really is unique depending on the situation. For example, I was working with one in the forum where a new business in the same category and a similar name started up where another business existed. The other business had 400 reviews. They decided to close the other business. Now, the problem with that, as opposed to renaming it, is that it's going to that closed business is going to retain its prominence and visibility for 6 to 9 months, a year, while the new business struggles to be seen. And in fact, can't be seen because it's in the same category as the closed business and thus is being filtered by the algorithm. What they should have done instead of closing the old business is just renamed it, sucked it up on the reviews, gone through the new verification process to prove they have a new name, and moved on. But instead, they chose to close it thinking that they would get rid of the old business. They didn't. And now they're struggling with both this ghost business and their business being hidden. So every one of these merger situations is unique, and the outcomes are not totally predictable because the way the algorithm works isn't predictable. But one of the things I would say is, before you start the mergers, one is be sure that your website is totally accurate, that the old websites are either taken down or changed, that those have been re-indexed in Search Console, that you have done, that you've gotten citations at the sources that Google looks at for business trust. Now, in the United States, that's InfoUSA/DataAxel. I don't know who it is in other countries. Sometimes it's a government agency, sometimes a government agency plus a primary data supplier. But you need to be sure that this new business, new phone number to website, is well documented in both general citations, but more importantly, in the primary data supplier that verifies the existence of this business. Because Google, like I said, is looking for orthogonal information to verify the reality of this business. And this has to happen month, 6 weeks before you attempt to merge. Now, once you then have these two businesses, one I assume is at the location and one isn't, or is it at a new location?
Well, it can vary both.
It can vary. So if it's at the same location and the name is changing, like I said, it's best if you, in part of the buyout, get access to the business profile and change the name, right? But if you bought another business and it's closing, whether or not it'll merge depends on how far away it is. If it's too far away, Google's just going to mark it as closed, and you're not going to be able to recover the reviews. You're not going to be able to recover whatever value it has. If it's close enough, you may be able to rename it and merge it, maybe. So it's unpredictable.
Yeah. I think,
because we don't know what the other parameters, the hidden parameters are.
Yeah, that makes total sense about...
Oh, hold it. It never can make total sense with Google.
No.
This is the most sense I've been able to make of it.
No, the reason... No, what's triggered there where I said it makes total sense is that before you start merging the profiles, you need to create an existence of the new brand.
Yes, absolutely. Because Google relies on the internet for proof. They don't trust you as a human. They don't trust consumers as people. They trust the wisdom of the crowds and the wisdom of the internet to make these decisions. And to get passed through the various verification processes, they need to have trust that you really exist. Again, that trust doesn't come from you saying it. It comes from them knowing it by looking at these external resources. And I might add, at least in the United States, I don't know about the rest of the world, they are now looking at credit card receipts. They buy credit card information from the credit card companies. So if there's a new, you want to be sure that this new business is, in the credit card system, accepting credit cards, and is being, charging on credit cards, because Google uses that as well as, proof that you exist. The other proof is people coming to your location, consumers, particularly with an Android. Now, with an iPhone, it's harder because they can't see that people are visiting it. But if it's a new location, that there are actually consumers coming there. So they look at a lot of orthogonal things to prove that you're real. But you should think about, in your mind, think about all the ways that they could prove you're real without you saying it, and make sure those are taken care of first for a period, because it takes Google 6-8 weeks to integrate this into their index before you try to get it through their Google local system. And that's true with your website. If you're building a new website, and particularly if it has JavaScript in it, which takes longer for Google to index, it could take a month for them to fully index that site. And if you try to put it into the GBP before that month, it's not going to accept it. It's just going to give you some strange error, strip it out, whatever. So don't even bother.
Yeah. One of the scenarios with a business profile and running a main profile with lots of businesses in it is I've come across once or twice that Google's randomly just merged two profiles without me even asking them to merge them.
Right.
Like two separate businesses, two separate brands, two separate phone numbers, two separate addresses.
Right, but the addresses are probably close.
Yeah, I'm not saying that.
This is an algorithm. This is AI. AI is a probabilistic view of reality. So in other words, AI is making a decision, artificial intelligence, as to which listings are distinct and which ones are merged. If the two don't have clear internet footprints, and if the two are in similar categories, etc., and if the two are in close proximity, then the AI is going to say, it used to be much worse than it is now. The AI is going to say, oh, it's just the same business, and merge the shit out of them. And then if you don't have the original CIDs, the original URL CIDs, you're never going to get them unmerged, right? Because Google doesn't keep track of those. You have to keep track of that. So pro tip here is when you get a business into Google, get the CID and the place ID numbers offline in archived. So if you run into these kinds of problems, you can recover them. And this applies to reviews as well. Sometimes Google will literally nuke a listing. You don't know why. Somebody will create a new listing. Maybe it's a consumer. Maybe it's some staff. And all of a sudden, reviews are gone. And it's got a new listing number, new CID, a new cluster ID, a new, you know, place ID. And Google is incapable of recovering your reviews unless you give them the previous place ID or the CID so they can go into their database, pull that up, and merge it. So pro tip, keep track of the CID of every listing. So if these kinds of mergers take place, you can document what they were. And if reviews get lost or missing or whatever, listings get nuked, you can recover some of that data.
Wonderful. How important would you say local schema is?
So let me step back. I mean, schema is a way to increase clarity of understanding by machines of your business, right? So the idea with schema is a structured way of delivering information to the search engines so that they can better categorize your business, put it into the knowledge graph, which is essentially a structured view of the entity. So as the information becomes more muddled, the schema becomes more important. Schema is not a ranking variable per se. It's a way of increasing Google's understanding. So if you're a single location business, you've been at that location for 30 years, Google, and your website's reasonably well designed, Google knows who you are, where you are, what you do, and schema is going to have virtually no impact. If, on the other hand, you're a multi-location business and you're adding and subtracting locations and you're changing names and you want to do everything you can to help Google understand this new set of entities, then location schema becomes more important in that. In the product world, schema is very important, right? If you have product reviews and you are in Merchant Center and local, and Google is, you know, showing product reviews with product searches, you want that schema to show up. You want those reviews to show up. So product schema is very important in that context, legitimate context where you have products and local and Merchant Center and you're delivering localized product results. However, product schema of reviews is widely used in the United States by lawyers on their main websites. Remember back at the beginning, I said in the law category, a lot of people look at organic. One of the things that really drives conversions in that is review stars. Well, the only way to get review stars in organic, in localized results, is to cheat by using product schema on your review stars, and people will be attracted to those reviews and will click on them. So schema has both has value for conversion optimization in many ways, for clarity to Google in terms of location. But I wouldn't obsess about it, I guess, is the other side of it, because Google's pretty good at parsing non-schema information into appropriate fields and categories.
Right. So why are you so personally passionate about local SEO? What is it about local SEO that you yourself, it just, yes, that I'm so, you know, because I can sense it, I can feel it, you know, the passion's coming through. But what is it about local as opposed to any other type of SEO, e-commerce or whatever? Why is it local that really, you know?
Well, I grew up in a family business. We sold cameras and sporting goods and motorcycles and computers, and a local family-owned business. And through that, learned how hard it is to run a business and maintain a business, employ people, and to be part of the community. And when local came out, it for the first time in 2005, 2006, became clear to me that the power of this internet, this could be inverted. So what I spoke about earlier, where all of a sudden the world could see my local business and I could then project my business into that, making the job of running that local business a little easier, a little more profitable. A lot of times it's just one market segment more that turns a business from profitable to unprofitable, or from unprofitable to profitable. And Google does that for many businesses. I've helped a number of businesses, very small businesses. One was a jeweler who wanted to get into engagement rings. And she literally was able to expand her business 3x over the 10 years subsequent to that by virtue of, you know, listening to me and following my instructions. Took her time, but over some period of time, she became the go-to place for engagement rings, which is a very profitable niche for jewelers in her marketplace. And so she was able to become, you know, profitable enough to expand and service her customers. So I'm passionate about local because I'm passionate about local businesses, or at least I come from that world. I know how fucking hard it is. And I see this as a way that can help push them, nudge them towards a little more success more easily. And they need to understand it.
Right. Just looking at the SEO industry, is some people would say in the industry that, well, local SEO is simple. You know, it's just like that, you know, it's just, you know, ticking boxes. It's just easy. You know, for the people that believe that, who's never really studied it in depth, what's your thoughts around that?
Marketing is important to every business. The right kind of marketing is unique. The combination of the right types of marketing is probably somewhat unique to that given business. Every business needs to find the things that work for them. For some businesses in local is very competitive. It's not a simple matter, as we discussed earlier, of checking boxes. But if you're in a category where people go to that local first to make the decision, and it's very competitive, then it isn't a simple thing. It's a very complicated thing, because it isn't just, it's a more complicated algorithm and there are more moving parts. And so it isn't just ticking a box. But it's also in lesser competitive physical areas or lesser competitive categories, it's a relatively easy way for some businesses to actually make an entree into the market. So there's no categorical local SEO is easy, local SEO is hard, real SEO is good, local SEO is not. All that's just SEO BS, which there's a lot of in the SEO industry. It tends to focus on many of the wrong things. like rank as opposed to customer experience. And so anytime I hear an SEO say something, I one, want to check the source, and two, want to check what they said, and three, I want to double check everything when I'm done.
Yes, that's a great answer. Right. Would you say that because of the nature of local SEO, that you're restricted to this geographical bubble, that you have to be a lot more focused around what you do to attract the right people in this right. geographical area?
Yeah, you do need to define your geography really carefully and understand the limits that Google imposes on those geography. And you may choose to market outside of Google's limits. For example, an example of that is organic. Organic has broader geographic, even when Google localizes organic results. Let's say you, again, back to this OBGYN example. You type in OBGYN, you're going to get a local pack that's going to be very localized around your locations, perhaps 2-3 miles around your location. But organic results may be 5, 10, 15, 20 miles around your location, right? So the organic results may offer an opportunity for geography expansion, as do AdWords, as do local service ads. All of those might offer geographic expansion. So the first thing is you need to understand what, in terms of focus, your geography really is. Where are the customers you serve? And which parts of Google serve those areas so that you can then focus on the correct part of Google? Secondly, you need to really understand which parts of your business are going to do best on Google. If you type the word pregnancy into Google, you're not going to get a doctor. You're going to get a list of sites from, you know, the Mayo Clinic or the National Institute of Health, and you're not going to be able to compete with those sites. But if you enter the word OB or obstetrics or OBGYN, Google's going to deliver you local sites. Well, if you write about pregnancy thinking you're going to compete in Google, you're not. So you need to understand which products and services you offer that are localized in Google that you can compete on. And from a digital point of view, focus on those and not worry so much about the others. You may put all the others onto a single page or series of pages, but you want to be sure that the work you're doing on your website and in your other local efforts reinforces what Google's capable of delivering to you. Because if you're working, like I said, on search phrases that Google's not delivering local results on, you're not going to win at all. So yeah, not just focus on what, where you do it and what you do and how Google delivers it and what they deliver, but then also focusing on the other building blocks of running a great business that have always been in the local space. Google has done a very good job, though, of transmitting those to the, you know, the internet. Things like reputation, things like support for your local charities, things like memberships on boards. All of those things, if reflected in a digital world, which reflect your real-world competence, also influences Google's understanding of your business, might show your business over a slightly broader area, or give your business more likelihood of showing PR, another example, PR, reputation, volunteer work, contributions, all of those things that are existed in the regular business world, translated to the digital world, help you expand that focus and do better.
Really? Now, over the years, one of the questions I've been asked from local businesses is, well, we're based in this town, but we want to service all the towns around our town as well. Mm-hmm. But we're just here. We're not going to set locations up everywhere. So what's the sort of mindset behind that? Because I know years back, you could, you know, like geographical duplicate pages and that, they work, you know, they work fine. But with Google now, you know, being very much localized and centric, it depends exactly where they're searching from, is where would you tackle that? Where would you come from?
So I think the way I would tackle it to start would be to understand which of those markets are more valuable than others. And I would do that via AdWords. I would start a small campaign targeting those markets, figure out which keywords people are looking for and which of those markets are most easy to compete in and most profitable. Pick a couple of those. Once you've learned that, I'd shut off the AdWords campaign and then decide what you need to do in those markets. If it's really a profitable market, then bite the bullet and open a location, for Christ's sakes. You know what I mean? If you really want the business in that market and the AdWords campaign indicates it's really profitable, then do what you have to do and start a new location there. But shy of starting a new location, I would create web pages around the keywords and the locations for those markets and do everything you can to get them to rank, and see if you can get some organic success. Get some conversions through organic success and perhaps supplement that organic success with AdWords in those ones that turn out to be profitable. But not all of these tangential markets are going to be that profitable. And so you need to sort of choose your battles and you need to do, I think, with data, which is why I would start with AdWords, target these zip codes, see which ones are good. If they're really, really good, bite the bullet and invest with a location so that you get the benefit of both local and organic. If they're just, you still want to experiment, then pick the higher ranking ones and do some web pages and target them that way and perhaps AdWords, see where you go with it.
Do you think there's a negative context from a user perspective? Say somebody's searching for florist in town and you're not located in that town but you're targeting that town, is that sort of a negative context for that person? Because surely the reason they search that town is because they want to go to that town to purchase the flowers.
It depends on the category and the meta information that's provided and how far people are willing to travel. I mean, I think it's important that you understand that for your given market, right? I mean, for flowers, this is not a life-changing decision, and people are not willing to travel very far for it. So it's going to be a less successful, but back to the solicitor lawyer example, where people's business lives are on the line because their jobs are on the line, they may be willing to travel an hour for that interaction. But if the title tags and the meta description look exactly the same as everybody else's, then the user's going to look at it and say, they all look the same. I might as well pick somebody that's close. So I see it as a dialectic between the searcher and the search, what they need, right? So, and I think the business needs to understand how far people are willing to travel for the service before they target it. I think that's a good point, but it's not a death knell. I mean, and it's like everything with local that we're seeing in our consumer behavior research, it is very category dependent where they look in the Google world, what they look for, how far afield they look. We're one of the few companies that is now doing that for multi-locations is actually setting up panels of people, giving them tasks. We videotape everything they do. We tabulate all of those actions. We ask them to make comments. We track the anecdotes. We take all of that to help a business understand where and how and why certain behaviors are happening so that they can address these questions like, how far are people willing to travel? And do they use organic results? How deeply do they go in organic results? Or how deep do they go in local results? Do they prefer LSA over regular ads? All those questions, only Google up to now has known the answer. And one of the reasons we started New Media was to try to answer those questions. And so it's been fun because I've been shocked when I see some of the results of actual users using Google. They don't do it the way I would do it. Big surprise, even though I always, I tend to project myself onto their behavior. So anyways, sorry.
Wonderful. Well, the time's rocking on. I do want to ask, I don't know whether it's a simple question or not, but once a business has done all the foundational work, as in every checklist out there, What are the three main things?
Even the dumb ones.
Huh?
Even the dumb ones, checklists.
They're all relatively, you know, the same. There are some standout ones.
Once
they've done all the foundations and got the, you know, all the boxes checked, what three things should a local business be concentrating the time and effort on?
So there are some foundational things that don't get broadly mentioned, and I want to just be sure those are mentioned. You want to be capturing email address and or text phone number from every client you do business with so that you can maintain an ongoing relationship with them so that you don't need to continually re-rent these customers back from Google or Facebook or wherever. These are your customers. You want to own that customer relationship. The way you do that is with great service and by staying in touch with them. So foundationally, part of every sale should be gathering email addresses and or text numbers and figuring out how they prefer to stay in touch with you. Then I would from there move into a review program where I then followed up with consumers after transactions to ask for feedback and ask for reviews, feedback so that you can improve your business and reviews so that other users can see that. And then I would likely set up some sort of email newsletter, again, to stay in touch with these businesses. So this is what I consider to be foundational, right? Obviously you got to verify your Google listing, et cetera, but those things are what I see to be foundational. Beyond that, then, you've got reviews coming in. You're developing ongoing relationships with your customers. You have a newsletter where you're educating them regularly about upcoming seasonal opportunities or changes. If you've got an opening in a schedule, you can let them know in that email, but whatever deals, you can let them know they like that. Then what I would be doing, would be at least once a year doing updated photography and not using stock photography. Consumers in our research are universally adamant about wanting to look at the staff they're going to be dealing with, wanting to look at the facilities, wanting to see, look in the eyes of the person they're going to be doing business with, and hating stock photography. So once a year, I would hire a professional photographer to come in and shoot all your people and products and business and use those throughout the year. Then I would focus on public relations, where I would once every quarter or so make an effort to get an article in the newspaper and hopefully a link or back, but minimally an article. One way to do that would be by supporting a local charity, helping them accomplish some goal, and then having the newspaper write about that charity accomplishing that goal with your help. This way you get seen as being a strong member of the community. You get a link from the charity website. You get a mention in the newspaper. And that's going to help your business brand in front of the readers that care about you, as well as in front of Google. And I would rinse and repeat that process. Reputation, email, imagery, and relationship link building in the community.
Well, we've certainly had lots of golden nuggets there that don't generally get talked about in the local SEO space. So I really like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking the time out to join us. Now, what can people do for you? Is there something that the people watching this can do for you? Or what conversations would you like to have and where can they find you?
So I'm a big believer in passing it forward. But if you want, we do a nearmedia.co. We do a 3 times a week newsletter. Mondays are typically about Google. Wednesdays and Fridays are more industry, local industry. So if you want, you can subscribe to that. You can find me on Twitter at M. Blumenthal and at Near Media CO. either or both. And if you want to email me a question, I have an open email, mblumenthal@nearmedia.co. If I can help in some way, I will try to. And that's how to get in touch with me. And if you have a question, that's how to ask me.
Wonderful. And do you have any final comments you want to add?
None that I can think of, other than I am going to be in London next week for Google's product expert meeting. I think it's Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday and Wednesday. So I hopefully it'll be good weather there. We'll see.
Well, we can hope. I can't promise you that.
Well, you're saying I should bring my rain jacket.
It'd be advisable. let's just say that, or a brolly. Okay. Many thanks.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Unscripted SEO Interview Podcast with me, Mark A. Preston. Join us next time as I interview more top SEO professionals.